Hi, welcome to the Frihof Institute of Progressive Halakha. I'm Rabbi Mark Wachowski with the 12-Minute Shiur number 38, When Halakha and Ethics Collide, Part 1. We're using a source sheet that you can download at our website, www.frihofinstitute.org/learning, and then scroll down to the 12-Minute Shiur. One of the biggest difficulties that serious Jews have or ought to have with the Halakha is that sometimes, and maybe more than sometimes, its rules clash with our sense of ethics and justice. Now, yes, some Jews will deny that difficulty. After all, they say, the Torah is always right. So if you see a conflict, then it must be that your sense of ethics and justice is wrong or misplaced. Well, we liberals and progressives see things differently. And as a matter of fact, so did the rabbis of the Talmudic tradition. They, like we, had standards of ethics that existed alongside the mitzvot of the Torah and often developed independently of them. So that when these two sources of normative instruction stand in conflict, the rabbis don't simply reject ethics in order to exalt Torah. Rather, they seek ways of accommodating the conflict, of interpreting halakha in the light of justice, so as to continue to hold on to both Torah and ethics. They do this in several different ways. In this shiur, we'll take a look at one means by which the rabbis respond when halakha and ethics collide. We begin with the law of the shor nogeach, the goring ox, Exodus 21, lines 3 through 6 of the source sheet. Ki yigof shor ish et shor re'ehu vameit. When a person's ox injures an ox belonging to re'ehu, his fellow or neighbor, and it dies, then they shall sell the live ox, divide its price. They shall also divide the dead animal. Notice the word re'ehu, one's fellow or neighbor, as in ve'ahavta l're'echa kamocha, love your re'ah, love your neighbor or your fellow as yourself. Now, one's fellow or neighbor is a member of one's own community. So the question arises, what if your ox gores an ox belonging to a foreigner, someone outside your community? Well, this leads us to Mishnah Bava Kamma 4:3, lines 11 through 22. Shor shel Yisrael shenagach, shor shel hekdesh, etc. When an ox belonging to a Jew attacks an ox belonging to the temple, or lehefech, when an ox belonging to the temple attacks an ox belonging to a Jew, in either case, the owner of the attacking ox is exempt from liability. Why? Well, because Scripture says in that verse from Exodus, an ox belonging to re'ehu, one's neighbor or fellow, which means that this particular tort applies only among members of the Jewish community. An ox belonging to the temple is therefore excluded entirely from this law. Sometimes that's to our benefit, as when ours is the attacking ox, and sometimes it's to the benefit of the temple when the shor shel hekdesh is the one that does the damage. Now, let's continue with the Mishnah's second clause. Shor shel Yisrael shenagach l'shor shel nochri patur. When an ox belonging to a Jew attacks an ox belonging to a non-Jew, the Jewish owner is exempt from liability. When an ox belonging to a non-Jew attacks an ox belonging to a Jew, however, whether the attacking ox was tam or muad, that is, whether or not that ox was already publicly known to be prone to violence, it does make a difference, the non-Jewish owner must pay full damages. See how the Gentile owner loses in both cases. He's always liable for damages, whether he's the defendant or the plaintiff, whether or not he's responsible for the damage, while the Jewish owner is never liable. The Talmud, beginning on line 33, notes the illogic, which is to say the injustice of this rule. Mima nafshach, it says, either way you understand the situation, you run into a problem. If in this case you take the word re'ehu in the Exodus verse literally, then like the case of the ox belonging to the temple, this rule should apply only when the two owners are both Jews, and if so, then like the temple, the non-Jew should never be held liable for damages. But Ire'ehu lav davka, if we don't insist that both owners be Jews, then why is the Jewish owner exempt from liability when it's his ox that injures the ox of the Gentile? That's not fair. This Mishnaic rule is a clear case of unjust discrimination. And rather than ignore the problem, the Talmud seeks a justification, a way of explaining the apparent discrimination so that it does not appear unfair or arbitrary. Beginning in line 40, we see that Rabbi Abahu and Rabbi Yochanan each offers a fanciful midrashic reading of a verse in order to prove that, yes, originally the Gentiles did enjoy equality under Jewish property law, but they forfeited that equal protection by their own free choice. Rabbi Abahu's proof is from Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 6, Amad v'yimoded eretz ra'ah v'yater goyim, which according to the Peshat reads, God stood and shook the earth, God saw and made the nations tremble. But according to the Drash, it turns into, God stood and took the measure, madad midah, of the earth. God saw and then permitted, hitir, gave a heter, to the nations, to the goyim. Now what exactly did God permit? Well, God permitted their property to Israel, as in the case of the goring ox, where the Jewish owner always wins in a case involving a Gentile. Why did God permit their property? Rabbi Abahu continues, Ra'ah shava mitzvot shekiblu alehem b'nei Noach, kivan shelo kiyemu hitir mamonan liYisrael. God saw that the nations which had accepted the seven Noachide mitzvot did not fulfill them. Therefore, God released or permitted hitir their property to Israel. That is, the non-Israelite nations accepted the Sheva Mitzvot, the so-called Noahide commandments, right after the Mabul, the Great Flood. One of those mitzvot was dinim, the obligation to establish systems of law and courts of justice. But when the nations failed to keep that promise, they suffered the appropriate penalty, namely, those who do not practice justice in their courts cannot expect it in ours. Thus, the law of the Mishnah stands as just recompense for the Gentiles' misdeeds. Rabbi Yochanan, beginning in line 49, defends the Mishnah from a verse in the Torah, Deuteronomy 33, verse 2. Hofia mehar paran. God appeared, hofia, from Sinai, from Sinai, which the Midrash reads as miparan hofia mamonam liYisrael. At Sinai, God confiscated or transferred, hofia, their property to Israel. Now, who are they in this verse, and what does Sinai have to do with it? Rashi on the Talmud explains, and we're on line 56, Meparan kishesibeh v'hechzir ha-Torah al kol ha-umot v'lo kibluha. From Paran, from Sinai, when God made a tour of all the other nations and offered them the Torah, but they rejected it. And of course, if one rejects the obligations of Torah, including the obligation to do justice, one can't expect justice in return. Rabbi Yochanan's comment is an allusion to a rabbinic theme that we find in the Mechilta passage that begins on line 64. Notice how the text frames this theme as a ta'ana, a claim that could be made in a court of law, in this case before the Beit Din Shel Ma'ala, the heavenly court. Ulefichach nitba'u umot ha'olam ba'torah kidei shelo liten pitchon peh lahem kelepei shechina lomar. The nations of the world were invited to accept the Torah so that none would have a pretext to complain against God. Had we only been invited, we would have accepted it upon ourselves. In fact, says the Midrash, they were invited. They were offered the Torah, but they didn't accept it upon themselves. The text goes on to demonstrate in an artful sermon just how each of the biblical nations rejected the Torah for reasons of its own, until Israel says memorably, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will accept it no matter what it says. The beauty of this Midrash is that it totally rewrites the biblical narrative of God's relationship with Israel, and it does so on ethical grounds. Now, let's look at the Torah itself without the Midrashic overlay. In the Torah, God has an exclusive relationship with Israel, The book of Exodus never says that God offered the Torah to anyone else, any other people. Ah, but if that's the case, then the nations do have a pitchon peh, an ethically justified claim against God. You didn't treat us fairly. You didn't give us a chance. If you'd only given us a chance, we would have done justice and kept the commandments, just as Israel says it does. So the Midrash responds that, in fact, God did give them a chance, but they said no. In that case, they don't have a claim. By their own freely given choice, they have excluded themselves from the Torah and from its system of law and justice. So they should not be surprised that they always lose their case in a goring ox law in our courts. Now, we see from this example that just as we do not simply ignore conflicts between halakha and ethics, neither did the rabbis. Here they prove themselves capable of reading the Torah critically, as we do, and they clearly acknowledge the injustice, the apparent injustice, in one of its laws. Their discomfort over that problem spurs them to seek a solution. In this case, their solution is to rewrite or to retell the biblical narrative so as to show that the Gentiles deserve what they got. That is, they get justice. Now, we may or may not like this particular justification or find it persuasive or acceptable, and that's fine. The point, though, is that the rabbis saw the need for such a justification, and therefore they created one. And in their defense, maybe it was the best they could do. After all, while we in our societies can always change or repeal a law that we find to be unjust, we're talking about human law. The rabbis can't very well change or repeal a divine law, a mitzvah of the Torah that they find to be unjust. Or can they? Well, that'll be the subject of our next installment. In the meantime, this has been the 12-Minute Shiur number 38 from the Frihof Institute of Progressive Halakha. Thanks for learning with us. Lehitraot.